The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to Michael Ulrich of J.O. Hambro Capital Management, one of the UK's finest large cap investors. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, given now inflation starting to roll over and the central banks are sort of indicating that they're putting further interest rate hikes on ice, what's your sort of broad outlook for equities going forward? Because obviously had a pretty tough patch, particularly of late.
Yeah, I think you're inviting me to be positive. And I think, look, and you highlighted a couple of the positives. Yeah, so accepting, you know, I'm not going to pick on, you know, one or two data points where perhaps inflation was a bit higher than we thought. The trend is slowing, and definitely factually the over here and over in the US rate hikes have been paused. So that's another positive. And then I think the other thing that's really been, I think, driving some of the consumer stocks is that sense that actually household balance sheets are in a better shape than perhaps you would have expected. It's the buffer they built up in the over COVID. So, you know, I think you started with your question sort of highlighting sort of that's the positive stance. And then I'm going to be, perhaps surprisingly for an equity manager, a bit more negative than you'd imagine. In the one, I think, personally, I think we are here sort of higher for longer. I think the central banks have been pretty clear about that. I think that decade long trend of low rates is over. And in any case, the point of rate rises is to slow the economy. They and they're pretty good at doing that. And they paused because they think they may have already achieved it. If they don't get the slowing, they'll carry on. I think as far as consumer stocks are concerned, I think there is, you know, that buffer doesn't last forever. I think it's running out, and we're still getting back to normal from that respect. In the US, you've got student loan repayments starting, and you know, in the here and now, we've got higher energy costs. That feels like that's going to be a kind of, you know, reasonably persistent, at least in the current environment. And in the UK, although I'm not exactly sure what the government are preaching, one of the things they may be preaching is fiscal constraint, which is different to what we're seeing in Europe and particularly the US, and we might come on to that. So our kind of way of looking at the world is very much, we're a fund that, you know, we're concentrated. We can talk about any of the stocks. We've only got 28 of them, so I ought to know them. But we try and deliver growth for the clients. But we do that in a fairly sort of low volatility way. So that's what you've got to end up getting. So to do that, we've got to look at sort of more structural growth, because given that backdrop I'm sort of highlighting, I don't think we can sit there and rely on the cyclical. So we've got to find the structural growth drivers. We're known for being a bit obsessed about sort of not losing money. So we've got to do that while we're focused on balance sheets. We care a lot about valuation and that sort of thing. And then when you've only got 28 stocks, you can be really sort of engaged with management. And that's something we sort of push hard on. But
Well, let's talk about one of those secular growth areas then, because there's certainly one out in reshoring and infrastructure spend. And there's certainly the federal, not the Federal Reserve, but the government out in the US has put all these, Inflation Reduction Act bills and infrastructure bills and spend and stuff like that. And it's been gangbuster for the infrastructure guys out there. And one player you've got in your portfolio is Ashtead over there, and it does, you should say, it combines that structural growth, but also it trades at a pretty low sort of 13 times PE. Do you want to give us your sort of latest thoughts on this one? Because given where the market is, it seems to be pretty resilient.
Well, I'd say, so we've got, this is a sort of theme that runs through the portfolio. So it's really important for Ashley. It's important for a number of other stocks as well. But, and you're right, the, you know, our thinking behind it is that sort of infrastructure trend that in itself is as a myriad of other things. So you know the geopolitics you've highlighted, onshoring, reshoring, nearshoring, all the stuff around that is in many ways just sort of political. There's the tech investment that we're going to need. People talking about a lot about AI. That's quite power intensive. Not to mention sort of data centers, battery plants, the reshoring of semiconductors. We could talk a bit about energy transition, And you know where we started, government stimulus, and you're right, those sort of three separate acts in the US, but also in the UK. And so for Ashton, you know, this stuff in super terms requires things to be built, assets to be built, infrastructure assets particularly, and Ashted is the big way I think for UK investors now to play that. And US is 95% of Ashted's profits. It's been growing in any case. It's the number two. It's a close number two in the US. And it's been taking share. So it was, I've known this for a long while, but its share was about sort of 4% only a decade ago. It's about 13 now. They've laid out really clear plans how they get to 20, and it's mostly greenfield opening. So it's that redeploying of the cash flow that they're making. It's the valuation that really doesn't reflect the prospects, and it's got a track record of doing this. We think we've got about 120p of earnings in 24, and it made less than 50 in 2021.
It looks like a long term good value play.
It's hard to understand the valuation given the long term trends for that market.
Yeah, and it must have good defensive qualities because it's got 27% EBIT margins as well, which just shows it's got that networking effect.
Yeah, and no one's, we'd be kidding you if we said it's not cyclical. You know, the construction markets, even within infrastructure, have cycles within them. The good thing about Ashton's balance sheet is that it's backed by the equipment it owns. So, in a slowdown, the first thing that happens to Ashted is cash flow starts to pour in. It pours in because you just take your foot off the brakes of buying new equipment, and you just age the fleet slightly. So the cash flow is kind of counter-cyclical, and that's the sort of the strength and the stability you get with Ashted. Yeah. They kind of control their cash flow in a downturn. Mm.
Another one in that sort of sector is CRH, which is quite topical because obviously it's moving its listing out into the States, isn't it? And so I guess this one, it's an aggregates building materials business, sort of tarmac and all this sort of stuff. And it trades on about 11 times PE. So I guess that this play is not only the secular growth, but also a re-rating in the States, I imagine, because it's 11 times is pretty cheap.
It is. It's done very well, but it's growing very well. We think of it as it was Irish listed, UK listed, it's moved to the US. So we think of it in many ways as a sort of a UK and Irish business, but it's the biggest of its kind in North America. It makes the asphalt for 25% of US roads. So it's a very big player over there, and it's got a really good track record of doing it. And it goes back to those fiscal projects. So there is increased spending on roads, but it's not just roads, it's rail, it's all sorts of other infrastructure. And size matters. So increasingly, federal contracts, increasingly they're sort of what they call design and build. So it's not just supplying the stuff. And there's only so many players who are set up to do that. And CRH has really, targeted that model, and they're winning, a disproportionate share even as the biggest player. So, these are in any case great businesses. They're high return on capital businesses. It's simply that, they're in many ways, they're often local monopolies. This stuff doesn't transport very far. So if you're you've got the quarry in that area, you've got pricing power. And that's the real, attraction of this business with that sort of growth tailwind added to it.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And as I say, with the all that spend by the US government, it's got to help that industry. Now, just moving on to an engineer, which is actually not too far from where I live, IMI, which does sort of valves and actuators. And I think it's just split into sort of two divisions it's got sort of the life sciences, and it's also got sort of like process automation. So it's pretty high value. And also for an engineer, it makes 19% EBIT margin. So it's obviously got a lot of IPO. What's your sort of latest on this one? Because it seems like a bit of a crown jewel on the FTSE 100.
Yeah, and you hear too many people saying, we don't make anything in the UK anymore. And actually, we've got some great engineering companies, and it's a competitive market. And if you've survived this long, you're doing something well. And you're right, those margins, the return on capital it makes, it's clearly a world leader in what it does and what it does. We could spend all day, but in simple terms, you can think of it, it makes valves. It makes big valves that go on power, things like sort of electric power stations or gas-fired power stations and in sort of up and downstream oil and gas. It makes valves that might be involved in factory automation, and it makes valves that could be in your radiator if you've got a sort of reasonably high-end heating system. It's very good at it, and it plays to a number of themes. So that energy piece, it's not much talked about, I think, but a big part of the energy transition, particularly the carbon reduction ambitions, is to reduce methane leakages. And IMI sell valves that help you do that, and that's a growing part of their business. They are very likely to be playing into the hydrogen economy as that evolves. And then in terms of the factory automation piece, as we're seeing the cost of labor go up, I think we've been through a long phase in sort of Western markets where it's just been cheaper to hire people because there's been no wage inflation. Well, now it's not. And now automation is sort of, I think, back on the agenda for lots of the areas where there was an underinvestment. And then sort of the last thing on IMI, and I'm quite fond of this, is the fact that its CEO, Roy Twite, has been there 35 years. He's run every division. 35 years. He's run every division. He's finally got the top job. He wants to invest and he wants to grow it. And he's been there only 2 or 3 years now, but he comes across as a man who's been waiting for he knows what needs to happen. And he needs to sort of free it from, I think, historically, too focused on cost efficiencies, lean engineering. Just sort of, it needs to think a bit more about going out there and selling and spending a bit more on R&D. And he's done all of that. We've since he's been there, we've had a 40% increase in the R&D budget. So that focus on organic growth, and it's paying off. So very happy with IMI, especially, at these levels.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if somebody has a good, given the amount of M&A across the whole UK sort of sector, it wouldn't surprise if they became a target of somebody. I mean, it'd be perfect for Siemens, but private equity at sort of less than 4 billion would make a lot of sense for a roll-up. Now, again, in that engineering theme, Smiths Group, which is obviously known for its x-rays and baggage control at airports, but does lots of sort of pumps with John Crane as well. And lots of good things to like about it, sort of EBIT margin 17%, similar sort of like mid-single digit organic growth as well. So it's got a lot of high margin stuff, solid balance sheet.
Yeah, look, and this is another one where there has been over the last few years change at the top, and I think it's been a good change. Again, a bit more focus on growth, less inward looking, just a bit sort of braver. And John Crane is their biggest. John Crane is a global leader in what it does. What it does, it makes something. It also makes things that are related to valves, but it makes something called mechanical seals. And I'm not going to explain what mechanical seal is because, again, if you're interested, look them up. There's videos online of this. But they are a world leader in it, and they're really important bits of kit. They go on things that really can't leak. And they play to those similar sort of themes I've talked about, sort of energy transitions, a bit of it. There's a hydrogen angle to this. There's an ongoing, much as we talk about transition, there's an ongoing oil and gas capex cycle as particularly some OPEC countries, realize that they need to get the stuff out of the ground. They're producing well below capacity. There may not be a market for it in the long term. And we've gone through a period of underinvestment. We're now seeing more investment. So, and then the detection piece, is volatile, but back to those Biden infrastructure pieces, they're building more airports. So there's, I think, it's like sort of 10 billion they're spending on the terminal at JFK. They will need more baggage detection stuff. If you're lucky enough to go through an airport where you may have noticed now they're saying you can leave your liquids in the bag, saves a lot of time. That's a Smiths detection. You'll see it on the on the machine as you go through. So that market is now moving for them as well. And so last thing to say, particularly, we talk about sort of low volatility and capital good companies aren't known as low volatility, but for John Crane, over 70% of its business is actually servicing the equipment they've put in. You know, these things can't go wrong. That's really where they make the money. That's the higher margin stuff. It's half of the detection business as well. So that it's not as volatile as you might think.
Yeah. Is there an unbundling opportunity here between the detection and the John Crane?
Yeah, look, I don't know if we're old-fashioned in this. Because we've got this sort of focus on low volatility, we quite like conglomerate businesses. We don't need to be carrying a business that's going backwards. They're definitely not. But I don't think that's true of any of those four Smiths Group businesses. So, yeah, there is always that possibility. They did spin off their medical unit fairly recently. Many, you know, if you've got very long memory, you know, they used to have some aerospace piece as well. So from time to time, they'll you know, the history tells you they will do that. But we quite like the fact that we've got, you know, if something does go very wrong in detection or something, you know, we've got four businesses supporting the balance sheet here, and it's a pretty strong balance sheet to start with.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody comes along and puts a number on them. Even the likes of Melrose, that kind of private equity style. I know it sounds a bit of a sort of leap of faith, given the market cap is over 5 billion. But you never know in terms of money. Now, again, just on the electrification and infrastructure theme, you've got two: National Grid and SSE. And there's a bit of an unbundling here on National Grid, because I think they've just sold about 80% or 60% of their infrastructure, their gas infrastructure in the UK. Do you want to take us? Are these two just pure defensive plays because they have that stability with sort of like, you know, long terms, long cycles?
Yeah, they you know, utilities and everyone starts to yawn. I think actually, I say I get excited. Rachel, co runs a fund with me, gets very excited about utilities. So, and one of the sort of, you know, the things we've sort of been banging on about at the moment is that investment that you need, particularly in transmission. So if you can imagine, you know, we're building all this offshore wind. We've got a fantastic opportunity in an offshore wind as the UK. We're already building enormous amounts of it. In fact, SSE are building, certainly in Europe, so it might still be the world's biggest offshore wind farm as we speak.
They've just opened, actually, that Dogger Bank, haven't they, as well? That's just been connected to the grid. So I'm guessing National Grid have just put their transmission lines to connect it.
Well, this is the thing. So SSE, so when we talk about, so when people think about the National Grid, it's the grid that connects. That's different in many ways, anyway, to National Grid, the company. And SSE are kind of are the grid. Think of them particularly in Scotland. It's true elsewhere as well, but the grid itself is divided into three companies, of which National Grid is only one. But Scotland's really interesting because that's where you've got a lot of wind power. You've got some hydro up there, and the generation is a long, long way from the people who are going to be using it. And you know, previously we needed to connect coal-fired power stations. Well, now, you know, they're not in the same place. So this is whether you're for or against this, this is a lot of pylons, and SSE get paid a guaranteed return on the infrastructure that they own and build, and so we call that its RAV, its regulated asset value. If that grows, their profits grow, and we know, you know, what's good about them is you've got visibility, because they don't just plonk this stuff down; it has to be agreed. And all those pylons and cables and tunnels that connect it. Well, we think that sort of asset base is going to grow about 75% between 22 and 27. And it could do the same again if you go out to about 2032. So that's not boring. That's pretty fast growth. I think it's massively underappreciated.
And it's presumably inflation protected as well, isn't it? Because it's a regulated business, they layer in or they factor in the CPI and then usually a percentage on top for extra costs into the whole return you can make.
Completely right. So there you've got your sort of inflation linked bond type of it, but the one that grows, and it grows pretty rapidly. So we've written about this. I wrote a piece, I think we titled it in the end, but it was called something like sort of Pylon of the Week. There is a website of Pylon of the Week for people.
That sounds like one of those stories on Have I Got News for You, isn't it? Right at the end, Pylon of the Week.
You may laugh. Actually, in terms of, you know, stuff we've written on you know, interest rates or anything else, got far less sort of hits than the Pylon piece did very well. So if you're like, I came back from Cornwall on a holiday and I did pass. You can just see, I think, on the M5. As you get sort of, you go that way through past Bristol, you can see the new T pylons. Very good looking they are too. I'd highly recommend
it. One thing about utilities, and that this is one of the reasons why they've been hit, is obviously they're classed as sort of dividend proxies, and also they've got a lot of debt. Therefore, they've got debt servicing costs. With interest rates going up and your thesis that interest rates will stay higher for longer, how's that going to impact the sort of like the returns and cash generation of these large utilities who have to service these big debt piles?
Well, you're right. So there were two things. One, it's very long dated. So they're not susceptible to short term changes because it's very, very long dated debt. The second thing is there's a very high element of it that's also the cost of debt that is linked in to the allowed return. Just as inflation is, the regulator assumes you're going to fund these things with a decent proportion of debt, and your allowed return goes up to take care of that. There's sometimes a lag, but the lag's covered by the fact that their debt's long dated. So the short answer is they'll be fine with that. That's you know, something that's all considered in their sort of regulatory settlement.
Okay, another one which is sort of like benefiting a bit from the decarbonisation is Anglo American, which I know has got a big part of a sort of Chile's copper mines out there, and also owns De Beers through its diamonds, and I think it's got an iron ore business out in Brazil. It trades at about 8x PE and has got, well, I mean, it's got a good balance sheet actually. It's been generating cash hand over fist, and EBIT, net debt to EBITDA is well less than one.
Yeah, look, you've got that spot on in terms of that's why we own it. We own it really for the copper assets. That's our main thing here, and that is very much linked to what we need for energy transition. You know, looking at spot valuations is always difficult because it's so driven by commodity prices, but on sort of spot rates and assumed sort of declines, it looks pretty cheap to us. I think copper is probably going to be a sort of 40, maybe more percent of their sort of cash generation next year. And unlike lots of their competitors, they're growing. So they're bringing on the mine in Chile. They've got expansions, in Peru, and they've got expansions to the mines in Chile and elsewhere. So you've got the right commodity exposure, but a growing exposure. I checked this stat before. I was talking to a client the other day because they questioned it, and it seems so unlikely. But apparently, there's sort of 224 copper mine discoveries in the 30 years to 2019. In the 10 years, there was only 16. So 224 in the last 10 years, and since 2015, we've had one in terms of significant mine. It's harder to find these things. They're in more and more kind of obscure areas. So, you know, Rio have the thing in Mongolia, Barrick have one in Pakistan. They're often in areas that have more difficult geology, quite often more difficult politics. So you've got positives on the demand, positives from a supply perspective, and an attractive valuation.
Just on the on that copper though, I mean, obviously there must be some geopolitical risk because Peru and Chile have started sort of like sequestrating some of their lithium mines, haven't they?
Yeah. And
is there any read across into copper at some point?
Yeah, definitely. So, this is why, at one point, some time ago, we've owned Antofagasta, which is 100% Chile. And my view is now, we really don't, given the sort of rising political tensions, we need geographic and political diversity. Chile's going through a sort of complicated piece of renegotiating its own constitution, and mining taxes are a big part of that. And they're trying to find the balance between how much can we extract from the companies, but still keep them wanting to invest and grow production. It's kind of part of the long-term thinking is that you're going to have to, I think increasingly, there is all the social license as much as anything to do this. You're going to have to keep paying governments as part of that. But the other side of it is it constrains supply. And we're really seeing that almost sort of offsetting it. And it has that's the impact it's going to have on price.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, just switching sectors now to healthcare, because this one has been, healthcare as overall globally has actually been battered. And let's do one of those really a best-in-class biopharma is AstraZeneca, which I think is the UK's biggest business. And it trades, surprisingly, actually, at roughly round about sort of like less than, one times peg ratio, given its growth, etc., because it's got big franchises in cancer, oncology, and rare diseases and cardiovascular. And do you want to take us through your latest view on this? This is really sort of like just a big demographic, sort of like elderly people type play.
That's the start of it, yeah. I mean, I always start with that structural piece, and more people accessing healthcare, people living longer. They're in some of the right kind of areas in terms of, oncology. So, the most obvious one. I think the other thing to think about Astra, and this is true for pharma companies generally, it sounds an obvious thing, but you need to have an effective R&D department, and they didn't for a long period of time. They were, in terms of sort of success rates, they were one of the worst, and it's kind of improving over the last sort of decade. It's reorganized its research franchises. It's got the sort of big campus in Cambridge. It's got the Scandinavian one, and in the US, so three centers with much better results coming out of it. And that's, it's taken a long time because you can't, turn these things around, suddenly. But now you're seeing that's come through in earnings and really importantly now, and this is really, you've had the inflection in cash flow. And hopefully you get on that sort of, general sort of hopper of now you're generating cash, you can pump that back into the R&D piece and that sort of flywheel keeps turning. So I think Astra is a sort of success story. It's got a good pipeline. We can see future growth. I don't think you're paying an enormous amount for it. And it is a, low volatility, not particularly cyclical stream of revenues and cash flows that comes to suit our book.
Yeah, no, I would agree. If people want to just have something which is a real sleep at bed, sleep at soundly at night type stock, then that's one of them. Now, another one in medical devices in sort of healthcare is Smith & Nephew, which I've been tracking for some time. And it has split, obviously, through knees and hip joints, sort of the orthopedics, but also has got sports injuries and also wound repair, I think. And if you add those latter two together, it's about 60% of the business. They've got a new CEO, haven't they? And I was stunned to find the shares after the sell-off are trading at roughly around about 11, less than 12 times PE currently going forward.
Yeah, it's about as cheap as I can remember it. And actually, do you know, there's some logic for that. It has not been a well-run business. I'm losing track. I think we've had four CEOs in 5 years. That's sort of like Watford Football Club territory, that is. I think...
Well, Chelsea manager, is it?
So it's not that it's operationally fallen apart. In fact, if anything, I think it tells you it's been it's a very good franchise, a very good business, but it needs consistent strategy. And we've got the current CEO, who has sort of stayed a little bit longer, has a strategy that makes sense. It's much more commercial. It's much more focused on actually selling product. You're right that the sports medicine and the wound management bit is much bigger than hips and knees. People think of it as hips and knees. That's the slower growing part of it. Sports medicine is a much faster growing part, and they are leaders in that. And the more people who play active sports, the more longer we live, the more health conscious people are, the more they are unfortunately are going to injure themselves. We've probably all done that. And that is a growing market for Smith & Nephew now, as well as a CEO who we've met a couple of times, who I I'm you know really encouraged by it. We've got a new chair who's only just started, who is Rupert Soames, who was did a fantastic job at Aggreko. Really, you know, saved Serco. And if you think about it, he's not going to know a great deal about medical devices. That's not his background, but what he is very good at is cash flow and capital allocation. And they're the things that he really fixed at Serco. And I think that's the missing piece at Smith & Nephew. It needs to improve what it does with its cash. It needs to strengthen the balance sheet. It needs to make sure it's generating you know, cleaner accounts, more cash flow for shareholders. And that's something I expect that we'll see. And I think that's the thing that, you know, will convince people who are sitting on the sidelines now, because it's got, you know, I think we've got all the pieces in place for this to be really strong. And again, another stock that is not particularly cyclical. It has, you know, it's as long as people need their joints fixing in and whatever they've done to themselves, they will sell product.
Yeah. And are they going to be able to turn that orthopedics division around? Because that's been the sort of that's been the Achilles heel, hasn't it?
For
this business for such a long time, particularly as Stryker has battered it in terms of market share with its robotic sort of orthopedics, or hips anyway.
Yeah, although actually, you're right. Stryker's been significantly outperforming everybody in that market. Smith & Nephew have lost some market share, but not near as. Surgeons are incredibly loyal to the product they know how to use. You really have to mess up for them to switch. But Smith & Nephew they've got fantastic products. They don't have a product problem, but they have a logistics, a supply chain. And possibly a Salesforce issue that the new CEO is fixing. So, I mean, as he explained to us, you know, they're spending, the salespeople who are meant to be out there seeing surgeons selling the stuff are spending half their time trying to work out where the kit is and why it hadn't been delivered. Take that off their shoulders, incentivize them to actually, you know, bring in some sales rather than do the admin. And I think you could see a big improvement in that area. But it's not product issue they've got. It's, you know, it's an organizational issue. They've had more restructurings and changes to sort of Salesforce. And I think salespeople want to be left alone to sell things. And, you know, we've got a guy running it now, I think, understands that.
Good. Okay. Well, another one, we're moving to sort of FMCG sector. Another one which is sort of like needs a perpetual kick up the proverbial to sort of like, you know, shake up the management team, Unilever and maybe even Diageo. Do you want to take us through sort of Unilever? Because obviously it's well known for its Dove soap and Magnum ice cream and Persil powder and all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, Unilever is one of those businesses where, you know, there's a Buffett saying about owning businesses so good even an idiot could run them. I'm actually not going to go any further with that comment, but let's say Unilever, I don't think, has been well run. I don't think that's a secret, and I think it's managed to, let's to be fair to it, plod along despite that. So there's my sort of view of it is, imagine how good it could be if it was well run. And there have been, you know, lots of I guess behind the scenes shareholder grumblings, meetings with boards. We've been part of a lot of that. You know, let's, you know, it starts in 2023 where we've got a new CEO. We've got a new chair who's just started. We will have a new CFO. We've got an intention to spend. Their problem is they just weren't spending for growth. So their, you know, R&D as a percentage of sales, CapEx as a percentage to sales, the marketing spend, all of those things went downwards as they tried to deliver higher margins and higher dividends. And you can do that for a short period of time. You can't do it for a long period of time because then you don't have any product to sell. So we've got, you know, new management in who I think get that. I think because you mentioned Diageo. In 2015, if you look at the numbers, Diageo and Unilever spent about the same amount on marketing. And, you know, it's definitional differences, but broadly 15% of sales. And since then, Diageo, which has done really well, now spends 18 from its 15. So it's gone up. Unilever went down to 13, and, you know, with obvious results. this is almost like the opposite of pharmaceuticals, in that it may take a long while to find a new cancer drug. To come out with a funky new can of Dove deodorant and a new spot, I don't reckon it takes that long. It just takes, you know, someone willing to put some money behind some innovation. So yeah. I think, and you know, the valuation is as attractive as it's been for a while. So I think this is a good moment for Unilever. I think it's going to be a
and Unilever's got that crown jewel, hasn't it, in India with its joint venture with Hindustan, I think it is, which must mean that once it does get innovation in its product set, then invest in it, then it's got a great emerging market, high growth sector in the most populous country in the world.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, and you know, the most populous, it's got attractive demographics, it's got an emerging middle class that are still moving to urban areas, and if you move to urban areas you spend more on FMCG. They've got the stories from a sort of demographic piece is really good for Unilever. And actually, you know, if you're, while we're at it, it's good for Diageo. So I think the temptation of Diageo is, I could talk to you about tequila in the US market, and they are you know, they are the dominant player in US spirits, and it's an attractive market and it's premium. One of the things we sort of forget about is that about 20% of its sales come from Africa. It's got this great African business. It's got the East African Brewing Company, but it's also got really big positions in Nigeria. Nigeria, you know, you talk about India being the most populous country. If you believe the stats, the Nigeria will be, by the end of this century, quite possibly the most, you know, there is very good demographics there. And another fact for you to take home is that the UK has long been the biggest drinker of Guinness. Ireland was number two. Nigeria has overtaken Ireland.
Well, Guinness?
Guinness. Yeah, more Guinness sold in Nigeria now than Ireland.
Wow. Well, that is incredible. I know the Indians like Johnny Walker, but I didn't realise the Nigerians like Guinness.
Yeah, I think it is that thing of, you know, the idea we think about, it's got a decent Indian business. It's dominant in the US. We could talk about its great Scotch as. I think we forget about that other piece of it. So I thought I'd mention that here. It's just sort of another sort of positive aspect. But it's, you know, Diageo has grown it's grown almost twice as fast in a sort of top line the Unilever. You know, its growth rate over about 10, I think possibly over 20 years, is somewhere sort of 7 or 8%. You get a couple of percent dividend on top of that. And it's a machine that will keep doing it. And we're at valuations that it's a similar valuation that it was on in somewhere like 2012. It hasn't been this cheap for a long while. So now's a great moment, I think, to own Diageo.
Another one which is cheap. In fact, the whole sector's had a lot of consolidation. Is the sort of the car dealers and car distribution guys. We've had the bit acquisition of Lookers. We've got sort of like a number of people sniffing around Pendragon. Now, I do see you own Inchcape, which is a sort of emerging market, more play in sort of, you know, car distribution. I'll take us through this one because it looks like a choice asset, sort of 2.7 billion market cap on about 7x PE, which, frankly, again, looks very reasonable.
So my view is that UK car dealerships aren't very good businesses. I don't really want to own them. So why do we own Inchcape is because, I don't know, 80-90% of its profits are nothing to do with UK car retail. What Inchcape really does, it is a distributor. And that means that in places, for instance, in Hong Kong, to all intents and purposes, Inchcape is Toyota. It imports the vehicles, it does the marketing, it manages the dealerships, it sets the prices. And it is the global leader in doing this for all sorts of car OEMs, for Jaguar Land Rover, mentioned Toyota, for Mercedes, for some of the Chinese players now. It does distribution, and the big growth, partly through M&A, has been more recently in South America, so Chile particularly, but other sort of South American countries where some of these brands want someone to do that for them. They've already got sort of the Asian piece. They have some European distributor arrangements, and that's really, you know, that's what they do. And over the last sort of, you know, a decade ago, this company, it had some of these positions, but it never won any new dealerships, no distribution contracts.
Yeah.
And for the last sort of 5 or 6 years, it's been doing it at a reasonable rate. It's sold a lot of its retail, and it's in this sort of higher margin, better growth businesses. The competitive intensity is less, partly because they are the global player in doing this, so they can invest in the systems and sort of data feeds back to the OEMs that perhaps smaller one country distribution companies can't do. And the last bit I'll just say on it is that, you know, so everyone's excited about South America. The bit to watch for Inchcape is what's happening to them in Asia. They've got the Singapore and Hong Kong markets, so pretty weird markets in terms of they have their own cycles and licenses for owning cars. That's about to inflect, and they've just won a number of contracts in Indonesia, which is a big country. And I think that could be really material for them. So, and you say on the valuation it's on, Inchcape's really interesting here.
Yeah, and it's a capital light model compared to the dealerships, which actually have to own the cars. So I'm with you. Now, just another one which is actually even cheaper, incredibly, is BP, the integrated oil major. It's trading at less than 7x PE. I'm guessing that's because people think that the oil price is going down, but if they've looked at what's been happening in geopolitical, that in Israel and Ukraine, it doesn't seem to be any sign of Brent decreasing anytime soon.
Yeah, you know, look, we don't have big positions in oil, but I'd say that BP is a business that is transitioning, and that's a long term strategy, and that's where they're putting an increasing amount of capex. So in areas for sort of EV charging, convenience retail, bioenergy, but equally at the same time, that's been funded by cash flows from sort of existing oil assets. And as you say, I don't think the cash flows from that are going down with the oil price where it is. And so even after all the investment and, you know, sort of 15 or billion of capex they spend every year, this thing on its dividend yield is only sort of 4%. Its free cash flow yield is 10%. The balance sheet's pretty strong. So what you're getting there is that cash is going to come back to us, especially if the oil price stays where it is at the moment. And that's a sort of cash return that we can redeploy in other assets where we might have sort of, I think, more clear paths to long-term growth. But really, it's the cash generation and the strength of the balance sheet of BP that keep it in the portfolio.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think people forget that the oil majors have been generating, just printing money the last couple of 2 or 3 years. And on that basis, their balance sheets have probably never been stronger on a net debt to EBITDA. Now, one, just turning again to sort of financials, you haven't got obviously too many other banks or anything like that, but just one you've got in there, which is a tech play, is Hargreaves Lansdown, which is a bit of a controversial battleground stock at the moment. The valuation has dropped down to about 11x PE. And I did notice that today, it's one of the most shorted stocks in the UK. It's the fifth most shorted with about a 5% short interest. Why is it so cheap and why is it so hated by certain people?
Well, so, you know, this is a stock that was on 30x. Like I said, we didn't own it then. We do have a sort of valuation control. Yeah. If you're going to think about running a portfolio of capital preservation, there are very few times if I can imagine where we would want to own something on 30x its earnings. What it seems to have happened at Hargreaves is, you know, they've been very successful, but I think they've underinvested in their back office. And then they had a bit of a profit warning where they said, we need to do some catch-up investment. And that was sort of, that was the thing that raised the eyebrow for us, because we like companies that are investing, we particularly like companies that have just gone down a lot, that kind of, you know, so the valuation looks a lot more attractive. And they've brought some really interesting people in to do that. I think they're constrained on how fast they can grow, simply because customer service is a really important part of what they do. And if you screw it up at the point when people are trying to sign up, you kind of lose that forever. So there's that. We've got to get through that piece of investment in the back office. That always comes with a reasonable amount of risk. But we've got a CEO and a sort of chief technology guy who's sort of been round to see investors over the last year or so. both of whom actually spent a lot of time at RELX, which, you know, if you get time, we might talk about. But
yeah, we'll talk about that next.
That's a company that, that knows a thing or two about systems and data and IT. And the I also have a lot of faith that they'll be able to do that. The other piece is around the charging structure. The regulator is on the back of the whole industry. I think, even that said, I'm pretty, you know, we're factoring in some margin compression here. They're not out of line. They're not more expensive in any sort of material way than competitors. And they get a, you know, I think people perhaps in our industry start to think that somehow this all investment advice should be sold on price. And actually, you know, whilst platforms aren't investment advice, they are. They do need to offer a reassurance that your money is safe and looked after, and that, you know, when you're pressing the button to buy a fund or whatever you're doing, that it's all going to work. And that people are willing to pay for that, quite rightly as well. You know, we don't want to be in an industry where it's just the cheapest provider that wins out everywhere. So I think they've got a great position here. I think that investment will come in. As you say, it's absolutely hated. It's gone from being overloved to overhated. It's good to know that the short interest is so high, because I think that's a good sign as well. And look, we haven't touched on, and I won't, you know them, that we need to save as a nation. We need to invest something in pensions, or we're going to be in a lot of trouble. That's a big incentive for the regulator and the government. It certainly should be. We need to get people saving more, and they are the number one platform for doing that.
Yeah, well, I use them, and I find they're fine, so I've got no problem at all. I also use AJ Bell, which is one of their biggest head-to-head, and they're fine as well. But frankly, there aren't that many. You know, we're talking of really scale and people who have that sort of, like, you know, custodial type of operation. Then, you know, you don't want to put your money with people who are, you know, very small, because you never know what's going to happen. So, I think you're right there. Looks far too cheap. Now, just let's go to RELX then, the data provider. What's sort of your latest on this one? Because it's the old Reed Elsevier product, but it just was it B2B data services for things like regulated industries, financial, healthcare, and stuff like that. Will it ever be disintermediated by generative AI?
I thought you were going to say, would it ever be split up, and we'd have that conversation?
Yeah, okay. Well, is that as well?
This is another conglomerate business, and I quite like conglomerate businesses, and I can't pretend that, you know, they'll tell you that there's probably some overlap, but they're I think the world's biggest publisher of scientific journals, but they've also got this sort of RBI data business, where they are interested in sort of areas like cybercrime, identity protection. They sell products to insurance companies in terms that they help people bind car insurance. They've got a legal division. This is kind of like Bloomberg for lawyers. I would think of it that way. LexisNexis. So it's a business model designed for the way we think about investing, because these are often subscription businesses. So you've got that low volatility. They come back every year. You've got pricing power. They're high return on capital. They generate lots of cash. So that's why we own RELX. And it generates cash. It invests the cash in new data sets. It moves into new product areas, new geographies. Same as Diageo, it looks like a machine. It's delivered sort of in a return. If you add back the dividend, we get that sort of 10% every year. Business become bigger, stronger. So is AI going to come and disintermediate it? Well, I think it's most vulnerable probably in its legal division, because that you know what's caught people's eye is generative AI. So
yeah,
lawyers generate reports. Could AI do that? And I think the answer to that is absolutely yes. So it's almost kind of an oligopoly, this market they have with Thomson. Thomson have just sort of acquired an AI business that will sit on top of all their data. Reed are about to launch theirs. I think the important thing to know is where I think you're going to be in trouble is this: if you're a business where the data set is in the public domain and AI can just reach out and grab it, and that's not the case for pretty much all of Reed's data. So whilst, you know, of course statutes there, case laws there, but the analytics, the commentary, the understanding of it is proprietary, and that's why people buy it. So I'm afraid that I think that the downside for AI in particularly in sort of in legal is going to be probably felt by lawyers, because you might need fewer of them. But I don't see the likes of Clifford Chance cutting their subscription to the legal databases, especially when they've got AI sitting on top of them. Because that's
they may actually spend more on it to replace some of their lawyers.
I think so. And look, it's a conglomerate. LexisNexis isn't the biggest piece of it. If it starts to eat into it, Reed doesn't fall over because we've got those diversified cash flows coming through.
Yeah. What about Experian with the credit checker? Because you'd have thought sort of like, I mean, there's so many of sort of regenerative AI, which is trying to impose individuals as in like, you know, to basically be, you've got cyber criminals who are trying to be somebody else, then actually credit checkers and ID sort of verification guys like Experian probably will benefit, I imagine.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think because then, you know, there's different types of AI, and if you're, you know, you say this to Experian, they point out we've this is what we've been using for years. This is the clever stuff that is making, you know, what looks like you've just verifying your identity when you make a transaction on your phone. There's a whole range of other stuff going on there. And the data that sits behind that, you'll be pleased to know, isn't in the public domain. It's owned by Experian. And so, it's not typing into ChatGPT, you know, is Paul Hill going to pay his credit card back? Isn't going to get the answer that you might need if you're a credit card company. So I think Experian are fine in that respect. And look, their markets are growing. They're using more of this data for online marketing. They're just like Reader, in sort of online fraud, identity protection. The credit decisioning piece we know about, they're selling more of it into markets like healthcare. And the other thing that, you know, people forget about Experian is, you know, it's dominant in the US. It's one of is the biggest player in its markets in the US. But it's also got this really interesting, and it's a material business in Brazil. And Brazil, the Brazilian credit market is only just opening up. It has a whole range of regulatory issues around the sort of data that you could hold on people. And that's changed. And Experian are the number one there. It's a big country and it's growing, you know, really quickly. And I think, you know, that's going to propel Experian from here.
Yeah, and there's lots of sort of like emerging market growth, isn't it? Because most people, you know, have got they pay for stuff on their phones. They don't do any sort of like, I haven't got a credit card, a lot of emerging markets, certainly. So now just turning to an area that you touched on right at the start, the consumer, the health of consumer. You've got best in class retail or clothes retailer is next. Do you want to take us through this one? Because obviously the guy there, I think it's Simon Wolfson, isn't it? Has just been doing a fabulous job for 20 odd years and taking market share hand over fist, actually. And it trades on roughly around about 12 times. So not expensive.
Yeah, look, you're right. It's best in class. Next is run in a way that I wish other UK companies were run. It's run for the long term. It reinvests in its profits in back into to future growth, and it doesn't make its accounts up. Try and find a negative exception in the last sort of 20 years of any significant size at Next, and you won't. I can't think of another company I can say that about. In that sense, its accounts are that clean. It's sort of remarkable. So when people compare it to other retailers and say, "Oh, well, this one's a little bit cheaper," I think, yeah, you add back the exceptionals and the rest of it, and you'll see that Next is I think a fantastic prospect in that respect. The other thing to bear in mind, right, sometimes joke that Next is our tech play. Something like 80% of the profits come from its sort of directory and online business now. It's not really, from a profit perspective, about the stores. It is the UK's largest online clothes retailer. It is bigger than ASOS or Boohoo or the others. And the bit that's growing isn't really the buying Next clothes online. You may or may know more about this, I think, if you have kids, because it seems people who have kids seem to buy lots of their school wear on Next. And then at that point, you might realise when you do that it's not just Next clothes. If you want to buy, you know, I don't know, Ralph Lauren or Adidas or whatever else, it's becoming the number one platform. And then on top of that, they're now outsourcing service for other retailers. So Gap closed effectively its operations in the UK, goes into Next. And so, you know, to give you a clue, if you look at the the Next website and the Gap website and the Jules website and the Reese website and the Made.com website, they're going to look pretty similar because the technology, the data, the logistics behind this is Next. And they're making, you know, good money out of doing this. I think this is, you know, they are leading the market in this area. Mm. It's a growing market, and that investment's paying off. So
yeah, you might as well use that economies of scale and that infrastructure which has already been there to help other people, but to make money, particularly if they're not direct competitors. So yeah, that actually ticks the box. So
the Amazon of UK clothes retail, it is. It's not just about the Next brand.
Okay, well, just moving on to consumers. Obviously, since we've all emerged from our lockdowns, there's been a lot of revenge spending on sort of travel, and both internally in the UK and at airports and rails. You've got two, Whitbread, which is obviously owns the Premier Hotels, and my wife is a massive fan of it. And then you've got SSP, which does snacks and food and upper crust, sort of like, you know, sandwiches at airports and railway stations. You'll take us through both of these because they've just had absolute barnstormer performances the last 12 months. But I guess the question is it going to continue?
Well, so Whitbread, particularly, you know, Premier Inn, is a wonderful story of a company sort of, as I would think of it, sort of doing the right thing in terms of, you know, reinvesting organically to grow its portfolio, but also investing in the product, you know, in terms of customer service, making sure the hotels look good. And your wife is not alone. They proudly show these charts of customer perception for the hotel brands in the UK with kind of quality and value. They're out on their own in this.
Yeah,
they are so far over the right in terms of the best perceived for value. But they're also at the top of the charts, bar one, which is Hilton, for quality. No one else looks like them. This perception that you can get, it's a rare thing. You can you can have, you know, the highest rated for quality at by far the best rated for value. And that's how you sort of grow market share. So they had about 6% market share in 2010. They've got 12% now. I think they've further to go. And, you know, there are scale advantages now in terms of not just sort of brand awareness. So, you know, you have to book it on their website, so you don't pay the massive commissions you pay for things like booking.com. There's brand awareness. You know, they advertise, you'll see them advertising on the television because they can afford to do that because they've got scale. And then in terms of, you know, sourcing is a big thing. So you've got, I think there's further to go in that respect. And then there's the German expansion. I've been over to visit some Premier Inns in Hamburg. I can tell you they look very much like Premier Inn over here. There's a slight German twist. But they're kind of, you know, they did a lot of research. They picked the German market. We're some way into it now. We're not profitable yet. So if you're valuing it, you know, we don't really value it on a PE, but if you did, you're getting nothing for that. In fact, it's a negative. And yet, we've got, I think, about 9,000 rooms so far. There's another 7,000 in the pipeline. Profitability is becoming, you know, the trajectory looks good. At some point, and I think it might be towards the end of 24, they may break even in that business, at which point, you know, that's going to propel earnings growth if they're successful there. So Whitbread is a great, great sort of UK success story, really.
Yeah. And I guess their competition actually in the UK, particularly for the sort of the value, high quality type residents that they do in the, certainly for small mom and pops, they've started to go out the business, haven't they, because they can't afford to invest in the bigger infrastructure that they need to be able to compete against them.
And you know, sadly that is the case that really these brands are you think of them as perhaps they take market share from something that's less well invested like Travelodge, but the sort of soft underbelly is the independent hotels that don't have the scale. They're not sort of necessarily purpose-built, modern, and capacity is going out of the market, and the capacity is going out at an accelerating rate, and they're not coming back. These hotels are being converted for other uses, for residential and so forth. So there's actually a supply shrinkage, particularly in the independent sector, and it's been like that for a while now in the UK.
What about SSP? Everybody knows their brands at railway stations and airports.
So I've forgotten the name of the one at the railways, but I was
It's up a crust, isn't it?
They do have a crust, but they've got this one of the regional railways that I can't recall now, but it's not very good. Yeah, okay. I was picking on them for it when last time I met them. But in general, SP is a really well-run business, and it has taken share in its market. There's two big players who do this, and it's big. The big thing really is we own it for sort of they run food outlets in airports, and they do this across the globe, and it's them as sort of auto grill. They've got about between them about a quarter of the market. And there are scale benefits to doing this because it's complicated. You don't necessarily think about it when you go in to grab something to eat in an airport, particularly airside, but all those staff have to go through security in and out every day. Every supplier has to. It's a complex operation. They're long-term contracts to do it. But once you're in there, as you also all know, is that it's not cheap because you are a trapped customer. You can't go anywhere else. You've got that, and they may run, you know, a significant number of those outlets. So this is, you know, good business with guaranteed footfall, a market that's consolidating. They're one of the big players that are consolidating it. Global opportunities, and then it goes right back to the beginning. When I sort of mentioned that airport terminal that's being built at JFK, the world is still investing in airport infrastructure. So they've got reasonable visibility. They've won loads of contracts they couldn't build out during COVID. So I think they've got another sort of 700 million on a base of 3 billion to build out over the next couple of years. So we're going to see good growth there, I think.
Yeah, and they're actually on a cheaper valuation than the likes of Greggs, but they're right up there, I think.
So, well, it's the earnings growth, really. This is still recovering. It's just really now got to the point where we've recovered post-COVID. It's taken a while. Yeah. We'd expect, you know, in terms of air travel, but the other thing, the last thing I think a boon for them is that we're all having to spend more time in airports.
Yeah,
you know, it'd be nice that if you could just run through, but the longer you and particularly you and the family are there, the more you're going to spend on food.
Yeah, and once they stop the railway strikes, that'll help them at Euston as well.
Yeah.
Now, just in terms of the sort of the backdrop, you're obviously cautious. Anything that the investors could take away as sort of like, you know, what not to do going forward. I mean, I don't know, chase stuff or avoid over leveraged balance sheets, the sort of the key mistakes that people might, you know, sort of like, you know, make and just try and sort of watch out for.
Well, there's lots. And I think chasing stuff is a good idea. Remaining patient is a good idea. It's our ethos. We don't need to be heroic. I'm running a fund so that people who invest in it might be able to retire. I don't need to, you know, put everything on black and hope for the best. We buy, you know, businesses that are cash generative, established, that I think are going to be bigger in sort of a 10 years time. The thing to watch out for, I don't know if you're going to pick one thing, I think the perhaps most topical is you need to watch out for balance sheets. So we, you know, we're in a privileged position. We get to meet lots of finance directors, but if you look at where sort of, you know, the 10-year yields are here or in the US, and therefore, you know, add a bit on for where corporate lending is going to be. The people who are the finance directors now have not been the finance directors of companies in an era where borrowing not just wasn't this expensive, but where it even mattered, you know, because the rates were so low, so many people, you know, covenant light, well, whatever, let's just get more debt. And they haven't really, I think, had to experience that. And I think number will get caught out. They, you know, they think they've got great relationships with the banks, and then they're fine. Oh my God, the you know, when I started, I remember a guy said, I remember being pulled up, and it was like early on in my career. I didn't know the interest cover of a particular company I was about to talk about. No one talks about interest cover anymore. It's all this net debt to EBITDA. They're going to talk about interest cover again, because you need to have the profits to pay the interest bill, and the interest bill is going up. So that's my number one thing to look for. Watch the balance sheets and make sure you've got, you know, stable cash flow businesses where you've got debt that can actually service those interest costs.
Yeah. And what about sort of like, you know, growth? Because there is a temptation that you go into things like, you know, the Magnificent Seven, where essentially you've got growth and you've got good balance sheets, but actually the PEG ratios are just stratospheric. Like Apple, it's about 4x sort of like, you know, it's about, you know, 4x, something like that.
Yeah, and there are definitely areas of the market, and so everyone knows about the tech names. It will be everywhere else as well. In obviously, anything with vaguely touching AI will be If you're perceived to be on the right side of it, and you're in the AI ETF bucket. But we can navigate our way through that. And, you know, we've talked about a lot of companies where I think that there are good growth prospects because, you know, we're looking at those structural themes. So whether it is, you know, we talk about Unilever, Diageo, and that sort of emerging market exposure. We talked about sort of areas touched by infrastructure, like early on, like Ashtead, CRH, energy. You know, we know energy transition's happening. We know the infrastructure spends going on. We know emerging market countries are going to continue to have a sort of a growing middle class consumer who's going to spend. Why not back those things? Because then I don't have to sit there and worry too much about next week's GDP figures. Let's think about the long term trends that, you know, in theory ought to align with the kind of the time horizon of most of the clients in the funds that we run.
Oh, and just the last one was obviously it's a cheap valuation and old economy stocks and stuff. But the banks, how come the fund has avoided the banks? I mean, what was quite enlightening is that they've had the Q3 US earnings season. They all came out with good sort of numbers and decent expectations. But the shares have rolled off, which says to me they've still got a bit of hidden ordnance in their balance sheet as interest rates rise and they've got those potential unrealized losses on their asset books.
Well, Paul, if the interest of time, I can tell you that I've written. So I think it's probably somewhere on LinkedIn. I've posted a piece on why we don't own banks, and there are a number of reasons for that. I don't think many people over the last sort of decade, you know, by the time you reach retirement, I don't know how many people are going to rub their hands and go, "God, I wish I'd owned some UK banks." I think the balance sheet structure, these are still highly, highly leveraged vehicles. They're not as bad as they were in 2007, but there's a lot of leverage here. There is a lot of political, I think, animosity as to, you know, as soon as they start to make a profit, they're called in to see the Treasury. I think that they have that against them. It's a highly, highly competitive market. Exciting is that everyone's, that they might be able to make a bigger net interest margin. As soon as we get to higher rates, then the amount of choice you've got if you want to chase that is startling. So, and the last piece is, surely we can find some better ideas than a bank.
Yeah, okay. All right, brilliant. Okay, well, thanks again for your time there, Michael. If anybody wants to invest in the JO Hambro funds, how best to do that?
Yeah, you can. Well, we're on every platform going, the JO Hambro UK Opportunities Fund. So I don't think we're shy on any of the platforms. And then you can go through our website and there are sales contacts who will be more than keen, I should imagine, to get back to you.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I'll have a look on AJ Bell and Hargreaves Lansdown as well. So
make sure it's Hargreaves.
Okay, it's Hargreaves. Yeah, I'll buy them through Hargreaves. Okay, well, thanks very much, Michael, and look forward in touching base in about 6 months' time.
Thanks, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.